And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, Tuesday edition. Today we visit with longtime Princeton University economics professor Alan Blinder. He's a Wall Street Journal columnist, a former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, and the author of After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead. He joins us from Princeton's Broadcast Center. Welcome to you, Professor. Glad to have you.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
And good afternoon. I'd like to start with the economy today. What are we doing right for the recovery, and what are we doing wrong?
You know, the truth is that on the fiscal front, I'm not sure we're doing very much right for the recovery, but I think we're probably doing some things that are right for the longer-term budget projections. There's a conflict between the two, because whatever you do to help the budget situation hurts demand. If you're helping the budget situation, you're either raising somebody's taxes, as we did on January 1st, or we're cutting some sorts of spending, as we've been doing, and we may do in a very clumsy way again on March 1st.
Would you explain more? Yeah, would you explain about the sequester, and if you think it's a solution, what would be the consequences if it were to take place?
Well, the sequester is a very silly solution. It's a way to cut spending kind of antiseptically, but that also means mindlessly. It was put in the law by the Congress in 2011, basically as a disciplinary device for future Congresses, on the thought, which is now looking wrong, that the future Congress, the Congress we have today, would not let it go into effect, because it wouldn't want to cut the military. It would not want to cut these essential services that President Obama was referring to, and so on. And therefore, it would do something else more sensible. That was the belief in 2011. It's not such a strong belief right now.
What's the biggest misconception of the financial collapse that we've experienced over the past 6-7 years now?
Well, can I give you two answers?
Okay.
One is that the bank bailout failed and that the TARP failed. That is, these big government interventions failed. Now, they had many aspects that people were bound to dislike. For example, lending. People thought it was giving money to bankers, but lending money to bankers was never going to be popular. But, you know, the banking system, it provides the credit, which is like the blood of our economic body, and you can't just let that cut off. The TARP was used substantially for that purpose. The other thing that was misunderstood was the stimulus package of 2009, where a lot of people have been claiming, against the evidence, I believe, that it didn't create jobs. I mean, to me, the notion that the government, even if it tried, could manage to spend $800 billion without creating jobs is fanciful. You know, you might argue it spent it on the wrong things, it could have done it better, and so on. There are many legitimate explanations, but at least some parts of the public have been sold on the notion that it was a waste of $800 billion that didn't create jobs.
Which you think is a misconception.
Oh, absolutely. It created many, many jobs. And in fact, it's amazing that people can harbor this misconception if you just look at the performance of the economy. Because otherwise, it was just a tremendous coincidence that we were going downhill, 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 downhill until about February, March 2009. And then we started climbing out of the big hole. That'd be quite a coincidence.
Would you mind, in the most lay terms possible, explain what happened that pushed us into this economic hole? I mean, most of us know it, but maybe just if you could explain it in just very, very simple terms.
Yeah, let me try to give the shortest possible version to what could be a very, very long answer, which
right.
I won't give. We Americans, but particularly the big financial institutions, created a very delicate house of cards of derivatives, securities, and other things built on subprime mortgages. Subprime means people that didn't quite have the credit standing to get a prime mortgage. The belief underlying all of that was that house prices would keep going up forever, or more or less forever. That could never have been true, of course, but that's the nature of a financial bubble. People start to believe unbelievable things. Had that come true, had house prices just kept going up and up and up and up, this collapse would not have happened, or it would have happened later because, of course, it couldn't go up, up and up forever. On top of that, the whole society was over-borrowing. The economists and financial people use the word leverage. High leverage means you borrow a lot relative to the capital or equity you have. So homeowners borrowed too much against their real estate. Some of them, in fact, had no money down at all in their properties. Banks borrowed too much. Wall Street firms borrowed much, much too much. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac borrowed too much. And, of course, last of all, the government was borrowing too much. When you have a financial system that's highly leveraged and things start to go wrong, leverage then cuts the other way. Leverage is very nice on the upside. It magnifies your return. But on a downside, it also magnifies your returns, which are now going negative. And that led to a number of bankruptcies and near bankruptcies, the seminal event being the fall of Lehman Brothers in September 2008. After that happened, everything started to come apart at once.
Why do you say that the collapse of Lehman Brothers was the watershed event of the entire financial crisis and they shouldn't have been allowed to fail? Why?
Well, on the watershed event, you can just see the course of events. Actually, things were simmering, of course, and not great, but the world was relatively quiet, the financial world, between March 2008, which is when Bear Stearns was rescued, and September 2008, which is when Lehman failed. And then after that, there was just a cascade of failures and near failures. There would have been a lot more failures had the government not intervened. Now, why do I say it was a mistake? Partly for the reason I just said. It triggered a near total collapse of the financial system. Why? Well, it was a very big firm involved with many, many other firms, both here and abroad. But I think a very major reason that I'm critical of in the book is that the government had set a precedent with its treatment of Bear Stearns. The shareholders didn't do very well. They got pennies on the dollar, so to speak, compared to what they had previously. The company was saved only technically. It was actually sort of tucked in and taken over by a big bank, J.P. Morgan Chase. But there was this precedent set up that a company as big and interconnected as Bear Stearns would not be just sent to bankruptcy court. 6 months, and that view got embedded in market beliefs. 6 months later, when a somewhat similar, not identical, but somewhat similar case came up of a company twice the size of Bear Stearns, markets certainly thought that Lehman would get some kind of similar fate to Bear. Not exactly the same, but something roughly like that. Instead, after trying to sell it to private buyers, the government just let it go bankrupt. This was a big shock to expectations in the market. It was as if the game that financial market participants were playing suddenly changed from baseball to football. And the participants didn't have shoulder pads and helmets and all the things you need to play football.
But you think they should have rescued the auto industry, Bear Stearns, and AIG.
I do. I wish I didn't. I mean, at the level of pure principle, you'd rather not. And if times were good and these things were happening in isolation and didn't really threaten to bring down a lot of the rest of the economy with them, I would have the opposite answer. I would say, you know, they should just fail. If they're doing poorly in their businesses, they should just fail.
You state
but the
that,
problem
sorry,
was there were a lot of innocent bystanders pulled down with them.
Mm-hmm.
You state that waves of foreclosures were anticipated by financial experts.
Sure.
Why were they allowed to happen, and are they still occurring?
Well, they are still occurring. Why they were allowed to happen is a continuing frustration of mine, because I was among the many voices. I was hardly alone. Early in 2008, they were screaming about this. This is way before Lehman, before Bear, and all of that. But you could see it coming because of the dodgy mortgages that were in existence, predicated on house prices going up, And instead, house prices were going down. So it was clear it was going to happen. So why didn't we do more? I think that there are a combination of reasons. One is it was going to cost a lot of money. And if you mentioned, as I actually did in February 2008, lending 200, 300, maybe even 400 billion to the financial system and to homeowners so that this wouldn't happen, you were basically thought crazy. Of course, later we did 700 billion in the TARP, 800 billion in the stimulus. The Federal Reserve bought trillions of assets, et cetera. But early on, a number like 200, 300 billion was considered just beyond the political pale. Secondly, it's complicated. It's not like there's just one simple solution. You have second mortgages to deal with. You had securitizations to deal with. You had mortgage holders who didn't actually know who owned their mortgages and vice versa because of the complex securities and securitizations that had built around that. And then finally, I think a quite important factor was what I argue was the misreading of political sentiment by a lot of American politicians. They believed, and I don't think the polling supported them, that's why I say it was misconceptions, but they believed that most Americans would look on relief for staggering homeowners and say, why are you helping Charlie, who got himself into this trouble, but you're not helping me? We were a good family. We didn't overextend ourselves, et cetera. And it would be vastly politically unpopular.
I think a lot of people were refinancing homes to pay off credit card debt. And the people who were paying their mortgages on time said, well, you know, why are these people getting bailed out?
Sure. And some people did say that, and there were instances like that. But we are talking about millions of people, many of whom were led down the primrose path to sign mortgage contracts they never, ever should have signed. Now, you could say, well, it's their own fault, and in some literal sense, it is. But a lot of these things bordered on fraud. And then finally, once the economy started going south, many, many people who didn't do any of those foolish things started to lose their homes for the usual reason, which is if you lose your job, pretty soon you can't keep up the mortgage payments and so on.
Right. We're speaking with Princeton University professor Alan Blinder. He's a former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. His book is After the Music Stopped. It's Topical Currents for Tuesday. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we're joined by Princeton University economics professor Alan Blinder. We're talking about his book, After the Music Stopped. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. That number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Professor, how about a lot of the politicians say that if we have tax hikes that job growth will be impaired. Is that true?
I think that basically is true. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why you want to do this kind of gingerly until the economy is on a sounder footing. The problem, of course, is there's always an argument to wait, 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 and we know eventually we have to do something about the budget situation. And by the way, we have been doing things. The President and the Congress have reached now, with great difficulty and acrimony, of course, but have reached two budget agreements that have taken a pretty big bite out of the deficit apple. A lot of people don't even realize that.
What do you think?
The economy. It does slow the economy.
What do you think a key would be to a full economic recovery? Is there one particular thing that you think would enable that?
You mean that we could do that would enable it to happen?
Yes.
I'm afraid there isn't. You know, the Federal Reserve, in normal times, we sort of rely on the Federal Reserve's monetary policy to keep the economy on an even keel. I don't want to say the Federal Reserve has completely shot its wad, but it's shot most of it, and it's done most of what it can do. So there's not a lot of power to push the economy forward left in monetary policy. Fiscal policy, were it not – so that's the budget – were it not for the budget deficit difficulty that we face, has the ability to power the economy forward. Politically, it would be extremely unrealistic, fanciful, to imagine that we would do anything like, in terms of magnitude, a stimulus program such as we did in 2009 in the year 2013. It's just not going to happen. The question for 2013 is, as we've been saying, how fast and in what ways is the government going to shrink its budget deficit, not expand its budget deficit? Now, if I had a magic wand, I would pair the two. I would like to see the Congress enact a short-term stimulus very much focused on jobs and pair that with a long-term, say a 10-year, since that's the budget window we seem to operate with always, pair that with a substantial 10-year deficit reduction program together. I've been saying this for a long time. I never expected it to happen. It's not happening except in some small ways. First, the president has pushed a number of jobs programs with modest success. As you know, the president and the House of Representatives are not seeing eye to eye, so there's not too much been done on that. And as I was saying a couple of minutes ago, we are making progress on the 10-year deficit reduction path. In round numbers, relative to where Speaker Boehner and President Obama were trying to get when the grand bargain blew up in August 2011, roughly speaking, we've gone 70% of the way with agreements to date, and they're now struggling over the remaining 30%.
Professor, run us through some of the highlights of your 10 financial commandments. I especially enjoy the, quote, thou shalt not rely on self-regulation commandment.
Yes. Let me start with that one since you raised it. The view emerged in the boom years in the 2000s and with the deregulatory Bush administration and the deregulatory Fed under Alan Greenspan that markets were very smart and self-regulating. So they would not go to extremes. They would not do stupid things that would imperil their own economic well-being. Never mind they might not care about anybody else, but the people that ran these big firms would at least be zealously guarding their companies and their shareholders' interests and not be taking undue risks, and therefore you could rely on them to regulate themselves. That notion, I think, exploded in our faces very, very badly in 2007, 8, 9. It's hard, you know, when you look back now, it's hard to imagine that people actually believed that, say, in 2005, 6, but they did, and it governed policy. My favorite of the Ten Commandments is – that's why I placed it first on my list – is thou shalt remember that people forget. Things like this have happened before, and they'll happen again. Bad times do come. But while the good times are rolling, we humans seem to have a tremendous ability to forget the bad times and think that the good times will roll forever. That, by the way, is one reason why you need to put some reforms into law. But people do forget, but if they're institutions whose job it is to guard against specific dangers, such as consumer protection and the new Consumer Protection Financial Bureau, then you're not relying on memory anymore. You've actually put things in the law. We did that on a mighty scale in the 1930s. You know, that's where we got the SEC, the FDIC, and many other things. People forgot by the the Great Depression was made a pretty searing impression. But, you know, by the time you got into the post-war boom, people were forgetting that. But we had these institutions in place, and the institutions didn't forget their responsibilities.
And some other commandments.
Another one that was crucial in the crisis was my commandment is thou shalt use less leverage. The inference, of course, is that we use much, much too much leverage. I already mentioned households leverage themselves up with no money down on their mortgages. Wall Street firms were routinely leveraging themselves up 30 or even 40 to 1. Think about what that means for a second. If you were leveraged 40 to 1 a 2.5% decline in your asset value makes you bankrupt. 2.5%, that's hardly a cataclysmic or even strange event. So they never should have had leverage like that, but they did. And, you know, that's one of the things that's better now. There is less leverage on Wall Street and in banks, but unless the regulators are vigilant, people will forget and will go back to that again. Another one of the commandments is that we forgot badly is thou shalt keep it simple, stupid. Instead of straightforward securities like stocks and bonds, which at least some people understand, Wall Street concocted these CDOs, CDO squares, CDSs, synthetic this, synthetic that, that it turned out when the bubble burst, even many of the manufacturers of these securities didn't understand. They were caught short. You know, it's easy to remember, it's easy to forget, sorry, that some of the people that did the worst things in terms of creating these financial monstrosities lost a fortune when the House of Cards crumbled. That in itself is evidence that they forgot. They didn't really understand the position they were getting themselves into. So I and many other people think we'd do better with a rather simpler financial structure than the one that we had prior to the bursting of the bubble.
We're always hearing about derivatives. Could you explain those and why it seems to be such a dirty word these days?
Yeah, it actually it's become too dirty a word, actually, because there are many derivatives that are fine. The general term derivative simply means a security, a contract between two counterparties that is based on some other security. So the simplest example that's of a derivative that's familiar to many people, not everybody, is an option on a stock, say a call option. So I can go into the market right now and buy an option which gives me the right but not the obligation to purchase, say, ExxonMobil stock, say, 6 months from now at a specified price. That's a derivative. We've had these derivatives for decades, actually hundreds of years on small scales, and they're generally not problematic. Derivatives were written during the boom years on packages of subprime mortgages. And then derivatives were written on those derivatives and so on and so forth. The problem that arose was the complexity that I mentioned before. Secondly, that most of these derivatives, unlike the stock options that I just was using as an example, were not traded transparently on markets. You can find out in 2 seconds on your screen what it costs to buy an option on mobile or ExxonMobil stock, as I just said. To find out what it costs to write an option betting that some derivative either wouldn't go bust or would go bust is not at all a trivial task. And to a great extent, the buyer is at the mercy of the seller because these contracts are not standardized, and you can't just open your computer screen and find out what you should pay for them. Those were the dangerous kind. And so one of my Ten Commandments, it's a little bit awkwardly stated at the end of the book, is thou shalt standardize derivatives and trade them on organized exchanges. The Dodd-Frank Act that we passed in 2010 pushes in that direction. I would like to see it push further.
We're speaking with economics and public affairs professor at Princeton University, Alan Blinder, about his book, After the Music Stopped. We're on Topical Currents. We're going to take another break, and we'll be right back.
And 34 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Alan Blinder. Let's take a few listener calls. Turn your radio down, please. Michael in Miami, hi.
Oh, okay, yeah. How are you? Am I in the air?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I live down here in Miami, and I've seen it very close to me every day. And the housing over here in the banks, they weren't related, like, through a Cuban connection. They would bring people from Cuba, which, you know, they always come over here, and they would use them to buy a house. You know, after a certain time, I guess, they would get their papers straight and all that, and then they will use them because they got a clean record. But they were not qualified. So on purpose, the bank was in combination with them. So they were going to the bank. They were bringing these people in, clean record and all that. And then they would purchase a house, which they didn't even qualify in. Then it was a plan. It was a plan to get them in, and then they would lose the house, and then they would keep the money, which then again, it was a $50,000 house that they had based. It was worth about $300,000. And then they would share the money altogether. And this thing would keep repeating itself, repeating. On top of that, it was all mixed. They were using it for growing pot here in Miami, which they still do. I've seen a bunch of houses out there. Which they were even stealing money from Medicaid, millions, buy houses, take money to Cuba, back and forth. And this is happening all day here in Miami. I don't know why the government. I mean, there's a bunch of other stuff that I can tell you guys.
Professor, could you comment on that? We have a lot of shenanigans that go on here in South Florida, as you are well aware.
So I don't know specifically about any Cuban connection or anything like that, but the general point is there were a lot of shenanigans that went on in this market. There were, for example, real estate brokers helping homeowners, prospective homeowners, lie about their income and their financial well-being so that they could get houses that were crazily too expensive relative to their true income. And, of course, most of those houses then got lost. There was a lot of flipping of housing during the frenzy. And most of all, as your caller was suggesting, there were a lot of mortgages made that were absolutely disgraceful. You know, proving that somebody committed a fraud is a high bar, and it's not always easy. But I think there must have been a lot of frauds, and there was certainly, without any doubt, many, many near frauds. So near fraud is not a legal term. That's a moral term. And there's just no doubt that there was a lot of that in Florida and elsewhere. You know, as you know, the big centers of this housing boom and bust were Florida, California, Nevada, and Arizona. Those four states accounted for quite a bit of it.
So we all know about this housing bubble burst, but what was the bond bubble you talk about and the consequences, and how much was the Federal Reserve to blame for that?
Well, somewhat. So by the bond bubble, I mean that the interest rates on a variety of risky securities got too low. So what do I mean by that? The interest rates on a risky security are higher than the interest rate on a government bond, which has no risk of default, because there is some risk of default. If you lend your money to a blue chip company, it's a very small risk of default. If you lend your money to a not so blue chip company, it's a bigger risk of default. And if you lent your money in the form of purchasing some of these mortgages, you would purchase them indirectly through securities rather than directly. You were buying a pretty risky security, but it was being pawned off as virtually riskless. And by the way, the rating agencies were helping with that by branding a lot of these securities AAA, the highest grade, the same grade basically as a government bond, when there really was risk. So when I talk about the bond bubble, what I mean is that the interest rates on these risky securities shrunk too low, which means the prices of those bonds rose too high. And, you know, the old expression, they were itching for a ditching, and they got it. When the bubble burst, the prices of a lot of these risky securities, it was more. They didn't just go back to what they should have been originally, cheaper, because they had risk, but went way beyond that because people got afraid. And people, especially after Lehman collapsed, people were running from risk, hiding from risk, putting money into the mattresses rather than into the markets, afraid to take any risk. And so you get it, as always happens in financial markets when a bubble bursts, you get an overshoot. So the prices of these bonds was first too high, that is the interest rates were too low, and then it went the opposite way. The interest rates soared and the prices went too low. By the way, at that point, some of the smart people were actually buying this stuff and turned out to do very well.
Professor Alan Blinder, is there a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
Yes, there is. I have a Facebook page for the book on Facebook. It's called After the Music Stopped. And I have a personal website, that you can find at princeton.edu, Princeton's my university, .edu/blinder. That's my personal website.
You just mentioned about the rating agencies. Were they ever held accountable for misrating the securities?
Not too much, but as you know, it's starting to happen now. One might legitimately ask, how come it took till 2012, 2013 to start doing that? And that's a fair question. I wish I knew the answer to that myself, and I'm not too happy that it did take that long. Hmm. But there is some effort now being made to do that. It's tricky, however, because traditionally the rating – two related points. Traditionally, the rating agencies have been protected by free speech. They're giving opinions. If they give wrong opinions, people give wrong opinions all the time. Mm. I'm sure I've given wrong opinions over the years, and this kind of thing is protected by free speech. And secondly, and related to that, as it's often said, being stupid is not criminal. So I think they made a lot of very dumb judgments on these securities, but it's not a criminal act to be stupid.
But if they intended to...
That is the key thing, yes.
If defraud.
That's what the Justice Department has to prove, intent to defraud.
Right.
That it wasn't just honest stupidity, but actually fraudulent behavior. It's a tough legal bar.
Let's take another call before we take another break. This is Dan in Tequesta. Hi.
Yes, hi. Appreciate your show. I would just like to comment on the fact that, first of all, everybody needs to live within their means. Not everybody can afford an iPhone, smartphone or whatever like that. And also, a lot of this housing bubble has been blamed on the banks and stuff. Was actually created by the Community Reinvestment Act, where the government required banks to come in and loan money to people that couldn't qualify, that normally wouldn't qualify, that they had to lower the standards. I mean, what happened to the old 20% down and, you know, where did that money come from that you had in your account for the last 6 months? Did your parents loan it to you, or have you saved it? You know, all the verifications that had to go on. Yes, there was some fraud, but a lot of these banks were told, you will go into these areas and you will loan to these people. And if you don't, then you will not be able to expand. You will not be able to open a branch. I mean, you know, that's like telling somebody that's sells pork sandwiches that they're going to a neighborhood where there's Hasidic Jews that don't eat pork, that you need to open a restaurant there because, you know, if you don't, we're not going to allow you to expand. I mean, so a lot of this was the government was complicit in it, and now they're coming back to the banks. And the banks were told, hey, loan it, don't worry about it. Freddie Mac is there.
Professor, your comment there?
Yes, you hear a lot of blame given to things like the Community Reinvestment Act, the CRA. I think it's way overblown. There is a little bit of truth to what the caller says, because after all, CRA originated. The idea of CRA is to prevent redlining. That is, it's kind of affirmative action for lending. So stop redlining these areas and actually go in, but find good loans, find good borrowers, and make them. It's relevant, I think, highly relevant, that the Community Reinvestment Act dates from 1977. 1977. That's about 30 years before it all came apart. It's very hard to pin the blame for something that really only started happening at the beginning of the 2000s. That's when the housing bubble really started blowing up, on an act of Congress that was passed in 1977. In addition to that, while the banks did a lot of these, poorly verified, undocumented loans, and that's true, and they take the blame for that. If you look at the details, you'll find that the lion's share of the worst loans were actually not made by banks at all, but by other financial institutions, such as mortgage companies, that were not subject to the CRA. The CRA is for banks. So that and a number of other factors, I think, make it a very, very hard case to pin more than a tiny fraction of the blame, if that, on the CRA.
We're speaking to Professor Alan Blinder from Princeton University. His book is entitled After the Music Stopped on today's Topical Currents. One more short break and we'll return. Welcome back to Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper and Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University, Alan Blinder. After the Music Stopped is the name of the book. Professor, I just wanted to ask if you thought enough punishment was meted out to those responsible for the financial crisis.
Definitely not. Let me give you, mindful of what I said before, that fraud is a high bar and being stupid is not criminal.
Right.
All that said, during the cleanup of the savings and loan debacle in the late 80s and early 90s, something between 750 and 1,000 people went to jail for fraud. That was a much smaller financial catastrophe than the one that we recently experienced. It is hard for me to imagine that the volume of frauds committed, the number of frauds committed, could be counted on the fingers of one hand without using all five fingers. But that's basically the number of people that have gone to jail in this crisis. Now, I want to repeat again, we don't want to send people to jail willy-nilly. We don't want to send people that made bad judgments to jail. That's not what it's for. But it's very hard for me, and I think it's very hard for a lot of American citizens to believe that we've apprehended all the scoundrels and put them at least on trial, at least on trial.
Yeah, it seems so unfair.
Do you have the feeling, Professor, that financial markets feel that they'll be bailed out again if need be?
Yes and no. It depends on what you mean by bailout. Let me be more specific. If you mean by bailout that the government's just going to not going to let the whole system collapse into a heap, dragging the whole economy down with it, absolutely. And we don't want that. So they do feel that way. The Dodd-Frank Act, however, has as one of its major titles what's called in the wonkish terminology orderly liquidation procedures. What does that mean? That means the next time a company like Lehman comes down the road teetering on the brink and the government's wondering what to do about it, it is not allowed to save it. What it has to do instead is seize control, like the FDIC seizes control of small banks, and wind down the business orderly, perhaps in a way that's consistent with what are called living wills that these banks now have to draw up and give to their regulators. So a living will, this is an analogy to the living wills a lot of us have about our health care, but it means something different. In this context, a living will means a plan to liquidate the bank piece by piece in an orderly way rather than a big mess of throwing the whole thing into a bankruptcy proceeding like Lehman did. So the law now requires that the government, in particular the U.S. Treasury, follow that liquidation procedure rather than do what's commonly called a bailout. Now, it's a valid objection that people have made to ask, well, will they really do it when push comes to shove? And the truth is we'll only know that when push does come to shove, and hopefully that's years off.
We have an emailer. It seems that his name is Jeff. It seems that what we lack in a recovery is confidence in the market future and Congress. This is evidenced by the downturn during the 2011 debt ceiling debate. What can be done to instill confidence?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think there is clearly a lack of confidence in Congress, and there's clearly a lack of confidence in both the business and the banking communities, as evidenced by the huge stockpiles of cash that they're each sitting on. part of my answer is going to sound tautological. As the economy improves, confidence will come back. But, of course, we'd like the confidence to come back first. Mm-hmm. That's very difficult. So I think it's a slow slog. I think one thing that would help would be for the Congress and the president finally to come to I don't want to say a final agreement, because this problem of the deficit is going to be with us more or less forever, but let's say a final 10-year agreement everyone's been focusing on this 10-year period, as quickly as possible, stop threatening to shut down the government, stop threatening things like sequesters, stop threatening to default on the national debt, and just make it clear, absolutely clear, as Alexander Hamilton would have wanted us to do if he were here today, that none of those ridiculous things is going to happen, period. Period. No ambiguity. There is no reason to doubt the creditworthiness of the United States of America. I think that would help.
We're a little bit short on time, but let's take a call or two. This is Mitch in Hollywood. Hi, Mitch.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a state-certified residential real estate appraiser, and there's certain rules that we've got to work by when we're doing our reports. And what I'm a little confused by are the rating agencies were doing essentially the same thing with large packages of mortgages. Now, I've got to research stuff, and I've got to try and find out whether or not this property is worth X, or for that matter, what it is worth. I'm not allowed to take compensation based on the value of the property I'm appraising, but the complexity of the job. Why is it the ratings agencies got paid more when they valued packages of mortgages for larger sums? They got paid more money for it. And why is it that if I falsely value, say, a dozen properties within a subdivision, I can go to federal jail, not just state jail? Where's the parity here,
Professor?
Well, you raise several valid points. The one I'd like to start with is the basis of compensating the rating agencies for their work. Yes, it is related to volume, but the most important thing that I want to emphasize, and which led, I think, to a lot of problems and still does,
with all due respect, they were being paid on the value of what they discovered, not. Here's 10,000 mortgages. How much will it cost to value them? No, it was, what did you come up with? We'll give you a percentage of that. Now, doesn't that sort of foster fraud? Because you're being encouraged to value it higher because you're going to get paid more.
The fundamental problem that you have to ask legislators about.
It's not legal.
But
for
the
me
fundamental
to do the
problem,
exact
just
same
can
thing.
If I can answer your question, the fundamental problem that we can fix and should fix is that the rating agencies get paid by the firms that are providing the securities being rated. It's as if my students at Princeton were paying me for the grades that I give them. That should just not be allowed. We should have a different system. The problem you're pointing to, the volume relation, is one subset of that more general problem, is that they're getting paid by the companies whom they're evaluating. That should not be happening. And it does open the door to frauds and near frauds. But look, even if the people involved are as honest as saints, we all know that if you're in a business, part of the essence of your business is to please your customers. And unfortunately, in this case, the customers are the firms that are issuing the securities. The customer should be somebody else, some third party, an exchange, the SEC, somebody else.
One last question, Professor. You criticized President Obama for not communicating effectively about what was happening and how he planned to fix it. How do you think he's doing now?
I think he's doing quite a bit better now. I wish he had done more early on, and sort of too late to go back, but... I, for one, I'm a supporter of President Obama. I proudly voted for him twice. I thought in 2008 that this then-senator looked like a fantastic communicator. He was very smart. He was eloquent. He was inspiring. And he would carry the people along, explain to them step by step what was going on, what the government was doing to alleviate the problem. And there just was way too little of this. And that led to tremendous misconceptions, such as one that I mentioned right at the top of the show, which is that people think we spent $700 billion on banks.
Professor, we've got to be wrapping up the hour.
Yeah.
Princeton University Professor Alan Blinder, and his book is After the Music Stopped. Thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's edition. My apologies to the many callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links, discussions, and more. We also have free audio archives and downloads at our website, wlrn.org. Tomorrow's program looks at the expanding scope for advanced nurse practitioners. Bills in next month's Florida legislative session could give them more leeway with patients. And the calendar. On this day in 1878, 135 years ago, inventor Thomas Edison patents the gramophone. Audio was recorded on a tinfoil sheet wrapped around a grooved cylinder. Sound made indentations in the foil. And on this day in 1953, 60 years ago, William Inge's Picnic premieres in New York City. A Pulitzer Prize winner, it was young Paul Newman's Broadway debut. One more while we remember Florida Maverick Governor Claude Kirk. On this day in 1968, 45 years ago, the first statewide strike by teachers in the U.S. begins in Florida. Pat Tornillo of the Dade County Classroom Teachers Association were at the forefront. Not much was gained. Decades later, Tornillo served federal prison time for corruption. He died in 2007. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from William Inge, creator of Come Back, Little Sheba, and Bus Stop. Quote, worry is interest paid on trouble before it falls due. This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Talk of the Nation next from NPR News.